Joel Katz, and you have found JFK Spotlight on Health, talking about the groundbreaking work done at JFK Medical Center in Edison, part of the Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. Serving us in Central Jersey and the greater Edison area, and with us this week to help us learn more is Mark Bober, the Director of Emergency Medical Services, Hackensack Meridian Health, JFK University Medical Center. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Joel. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. First off, thank you for everything you do. It takes a special person to do what you do. Like police, like firefighters, you're speeding into like uncertain situations.
That's for sure. And I appreciate you saying that. The frontline teams at JFK Medical Center and at Hackensack Meridian throughout the entire network have really been very hard at work over the past 2 years trying to make sure that whenever 911 is called, that people get timely care and correct care, and that we're keeping everybody as safe as we can.
Yeah, well, we certainly do appreciate it. What was it that led you to serve our community in this way, and when did you know this is what you wanted to do?
So for me, I entered the field a little bit later than most people do. I had gone all the way through high school and took my first EMT class in college. And for me, it was a family emergency, wanting to be able to do the right things and know what to do when, you know, a situation like that struck. I think that's the case for most people in our profession. Many of us start as volunteers and then from there kind of fall in love with the pace and the adrenaline and the fact that the back of an ambulance is actually your office and that you never have the same day twice. And from there, we kind of graduate through the volunteer system into paid jobs as either EMTs or paramedics.
So you said you started later, but then you said you started in college. When do most people start?
So you can actually volunteer at the young age of 16, become a cadet on a local rescue squad and kind of learn the ropes while you're still in high school. Many people in the profession kind of go that road. And ultimately, it really is formative. It shapes your perspective on life. It shapes your perspective on, you know, interacting with people and really, you know, very eye-opening experience from the beginning, whether it be the highway, the side of the road, when a major accident strikes, mm-hmm. or going in and out of people's homes and seeing the way others live, you know, it's different than your own background or upbringing. It really is a unique situation to have somebody looking to you as a complete stranger and then within 5 minutes earn enough of their trust to be able to ask them very personal questions about their health.
Yeah.
And have them trust you to take them to the hospital in the back of a moving vehicle.
So how does all that affect you? You mentioned, you know, your interaction, but what about, you know, you see some terrible things. How does that affect you? How do you deal with that?
That's a good question. And this really has been a focus of emergency medical services over the past heavily 5 years, but more than that, about 10 years at this point. We really weren't very good at identifying mental health issues, at identifying some of the less acute events that lead to major events down the road. We see some pretty terrible stuff on a regular basis. You're right about that. And it has a tendency to accumulate in the back of your mind. As police and fire have gone down this road, EMS has really started going down this road as well. And there is a lot more in regard to destigmatizing mental health aspect of the job and a lot more resources available to us, which is a good thing because it was one of the major reasons why it was very tough to be in this profession for an extended period of time. Just realizing that human toll that it takes on all of us and what really needs to happen to make sure that we all stay whole and that we all stay healthy really has been a big focus, which I'm thankful for because the profession truly needed it.
What would you say is the worst thing and the best? I mean, I have an idea, but the worst thing and the best thing about your profession?
So I think the best thing about our profession is definitely knowing that at the end of the day, you made it a meaningful, measurable difference in somebody else's life. I think that's the reason why most people in EMS keep coming back to the job day after day. It's a grind. It's busy. There are more patients than there are providers. And it's an uncontrolled environment. You never know what you're walking into. You never know when you're putting yourself in harm's way. You never know what you've been exposed to. But ultimately, knowing that somebody, you know, was in the middle of their worst day and you were able to make it better, I think is what makes most people gravitate towards the profession.
Yeah. Very rewarding.
The worst thing I would say is probably at this point, just that it's not on par with police or fire in that, believe it or not, it's not an essential service. There is no law in New Jersey that says that your town needs to have EMS.
Right, right.
You need to have police and fire, but not that third service. So in that way, there's not really a lot of pension associated with it. There's not really a lot of the same compensation levels associated with it, the same validity as a true profession. I think, you know, our brothers and sisters in nursing went a long way over a period of a very long time to legitimize their profession. And I think the same truly needs to happen for EMTs and paramedics in order to make it a career that allows us to have some longevity and allows us to have the ability to retire at an age when we can still do the job.
So what happens in a town that doesn't have emergency services?
It's a great question. And unfortunately, it's one of the things that we've really seen laid very bare over the past 2 years as the pandemic sort of unfolded and went through its surges. A lot of those towns rely on what's called mutual aid. In other words, the services in other towns to respond when they need an ambulance to come to town. In most towns, it's a combination of volunteer services and paid services. And more and more towns have moved over to paid services as the ability to volunteer has become less and less across the communities.
When you say paid services, do you mean I would have to pay in order for to get that service? And if I don't pay, I don't get it?
No, I mean in terms of contracts between the municipality
and
ambulance agencies that are out there, whether they be private ambulance agencies or hospital-based ambulance agencies.
Gotcha.
Just having a contract in place that, you know, whether it be 24/7 or at different hours of the day, that the town is covered by a contracted ambulance.
Okay.
And I think as we've sort of seen the volunteers take a step back during the pandemic surges, understandably, because sometimes it's a question of whether or not they have the appropriate protective equipment or, you know, just the way that the workforce has been affected in peaks and valleys by the number of people getting sick, that mutual aid request has gone longer and longer to be fulfilled. So here at Hackensack Meridian Health, we've received a number of requests over the course of the past months and weeks to help out in towns where we don't currently have a presence. And our entire profession is in shortage right now. There's a shortage of EMTs. There's a shortage of paramedics, not just here in New Jersey, but across the country. And we continue to see that shortage exacerbated by a number of different factors. But it is a huge concern right now that, you know, mutual aid is harder to come by. The response times are certainly concerning in that they're a little bit longer when nobody is answering that call quickly. And it's something that we continue to watch across the state.
Okay. I do want to talk about a little later in the program. You can tell us, you know, if somebody wants to get involved in EMS, we'll tell them how they can do. We'll explain how. But first, well, we're speaking with Mark Bober, Director of Emergency Medical Services. It is JFK Spotlight on Health. First, tell us about how EMS works and how the JFK EMS Command Center is different compared to the rest of the country.
Sure. Absolutely, Joel. So I'll start with how EMS works in New Jersey because it is different than most other places.
Mm-hmm.
Here in New Jersey, when you call 911, you are funneled through a center that basically asks you where your emergency is and what type of emergency you have. And if it is a medical emergency, then some call screening transpires that allows them to determine the nature and the acuity of the emergency. So lower-level emergencies, basic emergencies, things like, you know, simple abdominal pain or a sprain or a cut or a bruise or, you know, even a break, things along those lines, that is a basic life support level response. And that is the local EMTs in the ambulance, and that could be volunteer, could be paid, it could be fire-based, it could be police-based, it could be hospital-based. But those resources are much more plentiful than the next level, which is advanced life support. If your emergency is of a higher level of acuity, like a stroke or a heart attack or an unconscious or a cardiac arrest, at that point you receive not only a basic life support response from the EMTs, but a secondary response from the paramedics in the advanced life support unit as well. Paramedic units are all hospital-based. There are no volunteer paramedics in New Jersey that are hospital-based. And ultimately, that resource is a lot more scarce than the basic life support resource. Mm-hmm. A single town does not have its own paramedic unit, but rather paramedics are assigned to regional areas to cover larger swaths of geography than just a single municipality. And ultimately, that's why in the most serious emergencies, you may see two ambulances or an ambulance and an SUV riding side by side on the way to the hospital.
I see. So if it's a call like, I think I broke my leg, that would be considered a less severe, and it would be one vehicle, right? The emergency services. Tell me if I'm right.
Right.
And then if I call and say, my dad passed out, is unconscious, then you would send out the emergency services and the paramedic.
Correct. And ultimately, it comes down to the scope of care that they can provide. When it comes to the EMTs and the basics, the EMTs are able to provide oxygen. They have automated external defibrillators with them, a number of different medications that are a little bit less invasive. And when it comes to the paramedics, that's basically like the emergency department coming into your living room, about 45 different medications, invasive procedures, and ultimately they are online with an emergency room physician having conversations about your care as they deliver that care.
Now, I was reading that JFK EMS uses something called high-performance EMS.
That's correct. So ultimately, we have a number of different areas that we serve, and the goal is to minimize the response times, and also in minimizing the response times, the amount of impact on the community as we travel with our lights and our sirens running. Most people don't understand that that is an incredibly, incredibly risky moment, not only to us, but also to the public in general. Anytime we go through an uncontrolled intersection against a light or things like that, there is always an opportunity for wake effect accidents. There's always an opportunity for things to go wrong. So we use a map and we use predictive modeling to try and place our ambulances in the best location to be able to respond quickly and be able to respond safely to where we believe the next emergencies will show up.
So they're not all in one spot waiting to go.
They're not all in one spot waiting to go. Exactly. Okay. So it sounds a little bit like, you know, kind of looking into the crystal ball, but in reality, it's just, basically taking data and aggregating that data for population migrations and the times when the most people are in the most places. So in reality, we find ourselves with a heat map that looks a lot like a weather map, and we position our ambulances at the hottest spots on that heat map to be able to respond quickly. And we find it to be greater than 80% effective on a regular basis.
Wow. So they're sitting somewhere, like in a parking lot, or you have locations?
Our system is a little bit unique in that we also service the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. So we have ambulances that are out there just ready for the 911 call that comes in. And we also have ambulances that are taking patients from A to B, from hospital A to hospital B, or to a dialysis appointment or to a nursing home. And we are able to use all of those ambulances to float in and out of those areas and make sure that at any given time, the areas that we cover are as covered as they possibly can be. It involves a lot of moving, a lot of shifting. Our communication center, our dispatchers are phenomenal at what they do. They have a lot of subject matter expertise and a lot of knowledge and experience with the communities that we serve. And we also have a great, strong link to volunteers in most of the communities we serve as well. So much, in fact, that they're actually integrated into our response system, and we respond side by side with them. And if they're closer to a job, we make sure that they go. And if we're closer to a job, they make sure that we go. It's a great partnership.
Well, the logistics seems so hard.
Well, thank you for saying that.
I mean, it seems impossible.
The sheer amount of work that's involved in making sure that the ambulance coming to your house gets there quickly and gets there safely. But it's something that we pride ourselves on.
That's a lot of thinking. So I'm at my house. Something happens. I call 911. What should I expect?
That's a good question. I think what you need to expect in that moment is a number of different questions. And what you need to know is that time tends to dilate. It tends to happen a lot slower to you than it's actually happening in the real world.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And as we continue to ask questions to clarify, to make sure that the right resources are coming and that we have the best information on the location, the ambulance is probably already dispatched. So although you continue to talk to a dispatcher on the phone, help is already on the way. From there, they'll ask questions to make sure that we understand whether it should just be the EMTs or the EMTs and the paramedics as well. And we'll ask you a number of different questions about your location to make sure that we understand how we're going to access whoever the patient is that you're calling about. So if it's the middle of the night, we'll remind you for things like turning the lights on, securing any pets, if it's a situation where somebody has a dog at home, things like that, potentially gathering medications. If you have a file of life, which is one of those things that most people have on the refrigerator that gives basic pertinent information, gathering all that so that we can very quickly assess the situation, get as much information as we can on the specific patient that we're seeing, and make sure that the entire encounter is as safe for the patient and the providers as it possibly can be. Obviously new over the course of the past 2 years, there's also a screening algorithm that involves whether or not a patient may or may not have COVID symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And that, once again, is designed to protect everybody, to make sure that we're wearing the proper protective equipment when we walk in the door to somebody who could potentially be contagious. obviously, we're no good to anybody if our workforce is sick and unable to respond.
Right.
So that's a big part of it these days.
Yeah,
as well.
That changed things big time, huh?
Yes, it has, for sure. In so many different ways, too. You know, even beyond the call screening, you know, the availability of PPE, making sure in the beginning that was one of the hardest things to make sure that all the responders had what they needed. But the amount of time that we spend on scene is longer at this point. The amount of time we spend bringing patients in and out of the hospital is longer. Those hospital drop times, as we call them, have definitely expanded for sure.
Right, you can't just rush them in. Yeah,
decontaminating our ambulances has definitely gotten a lot longer as well.
Right.
Yeah, the providers out there, let me tell you, you know, just to take a minute and talk about the providers themselves.
Okay.
It has become a much harder job than it ever was before. And I give every one of our providers a tremendous amount of credit for the dedication that they bring forward every day. The desire to constantly put other people first when it comes to you yourself, your safety, or when it comes to the safety of your family, or, you know, who knows what you have going on at home, who's sick, or who you're trying to make sure is, you know, getting schooled appropriately. The fact that so many providers come back day after day to do this job for nothing other than, you know, really the idea of helping their fellow man. I can tell you nobody's getting rich in EMS, that's for sure. But ultimately, the dedication that they show and have shown over the past 2 years has been truly inspirational.
Yeah. I mean, anybody who doesn't realize that is not paying attention. Anybody in the medical field, but especially, I mean, there's so much more you need to be aware of and you have to be careful about. It's just, it's mind-boggling.
It is.
When you have a patient being taken to the hospital, do the doctors, do the nurses, do they have what info do they have before you get there? Or do you just show up and they say, hey, what's the problem? Not that they would say it like that.
That's one of the parts of our system that we are constantly working to evolve a little bit. And right now, that really depends on whether or not you are at the basic life support level or at the advanced life support level in most cases. I think there are definitely basic life support EMTs who are very good at making hospital notification, but there is no requirement that on every single encounter, a basic life support ambulance makes notification to the hospital. At the advanced life support level, the paramedics are already on the phone with the doctors. They're already having a conversation with an ED physician about the care of the patient. And 100% of those jobs involve notification to the hospital prior to us getting there. But those lesser emergencies, they may not know that you're coming. They may not necessarily know that an ambulance is pulling up into the bay and about to walk through the doors. And I can certainly tell you, as the emergency departments got more and more crowded, that the trip by ambulance did not necessarily equate to faster care when you got there. If you were among the sickest of the sick, sure, you get whisked right in, you get treated right away. But just arrival by ambulance does not guarantee that you're going to be seen in any different order than if you showed up in your personal vehicle.
Right. But people are panicked, right? So that's, I mean, you touched on earlier about the 911 call. Why are you asking me these questions? You should be here by now. You know, you have to get that kind of response. And then when you get there, it's like, why am I sitting in this chair for 10 minutes?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. How do you deal with that?
And often, am I being asked the same questions that I just answered when I was in the back of the ambulance? I think there are some integrative steps that, you know, we all hope are going to be taken in the relatively near future to kind of integrate the entire EMS system a little bit more with the hospital system. And I think at a place like Hackensack Meridian Health, we have a lot of those things in place, as do many other hospital-based emergency medical services. But it's important to keep in mind that many of the emergency medical services providers out there are not hospital-based, and some are very, very good at making those connections and working closely with their local hospitals, and others don't have the resources or the capacity to do so as thoroughly. So it is a little bit of a fragmented system in that regard, but I think generally everybody out there giving of their time and, you know, giving of themselves in this way definitely deserves credit for the work that they are able to perform, whether that be simply holding a hand on the way to the hospital or stabilizing a life-threatening emergency.
Talking with Mark Bober, Director of Emergency Medical Services, JFK Medical Center, serving us here in Central Jersey. Now, we touched on, you know, the 911 call and how that is dealt with. I don't know if you mentioned this, but you're the first on the scene. When you get there, what is the process? What is you're not kicking the door down. What is the process when you get to a home or wherever you have to go for an emergency?
So I have to give credit for sure to all the first responders out there as well. In many cases, the ambulance may not be the first one arriving. Many towns have a very robust police response, and some towns also have their fire departments built in as first responders as well. So depending on the closest resource to the medical emergency, it could very easily be a police officer that's first through the door. Okay. And we certainly like to see that because that means that an initial scene size up and a safety assessment has already been performed when we get there. But that is number one priority when we do arrive as the first ones on scene, to make sure that the scene is safe and to make sure that nothing occurs that makes us become patients ourselves, because we're not going to be good to anybody else if we then need an ambulance ourselves. So that's the biggest part of it. From there, as we talked about a little bit, layering in the screening questions related to the pandemic and related to COVID symptomology is always a big part of what we still do. And that's been that way with other things as well. You know, peaks and valleys when there were Ebola scares and things like that, we've always had the ability to layer in those initial assessment questions. But from there, it's really about establishing that rapport, finding out the chief complaint of the person sitting in front of you, gathering as much information as quickly as we possibly can while also stabilizing whatever's going on. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're not going to ask a ton of questions to somebody who's short of breath. The priority then becomes simply putting that person on oxygen and making sure that we stabilize the emergency. Mm-hmm. But the goal is to gather as much information from the scene, play medical detective, because we are the only ones who are going to view what that accident looks like, how that car was impacted, or the state of the home, or you know, where we find the patient, and be sure that we convey as much of that information as well as the pertinent information related to the patient and the patient's care when we drop them off at the emergency department.
Before we end the program, I want to make sure that we do talk about, you know, those who may be interested to get involved in EMS, but I do want to follow up with that question. And it just made me think, you get to a house, maybe I collapse, and before I'm unconscious, I make the phone call to 911. You get there, I'm the only one there, and I'm unconscious. How do you determine what to do? Is it blood pressure, checking my breathing, heart rate, that type of stuff?
So
you don't know what's wrong.
There's always an algorithm, right? And our algorithm always starts with ABC, which is the airway, breathing, and circulation. So anybody who has taken a CPR class is taught that same algorithm, and we always start with the basics as well. No matter how advanced things get on the scene, if you're at that paramedic level, the paramedics, the EMTs, the first responders, everybody starts with airway, breathing, circulation. And from there, if we're in front of a person who can't answer any questions or is not conscious, we just move right to airway. If the airway is open, we move right to breathing for somebody who's not breathing for themselves. Mm-hmm. Or providing oxygen to assist with breathing. And then from there, we'll eventually get to things like checking the patient's pulse and blood pressure, and making sure that the heart rate is regular, things along those lines. But it's always ABCs as soon as we walk in the door.
Okay. And real quick, before we get to the volunteers, a lot of people wonder this as well. All right, it's me. We all wonder. Do ambulances, can they change stoplights? If they're coming to a red light, is there something they can hit to make it change green? Change to green?
In some towns, they can. Not in all places, but in some towns they certainly can. There is definitely a button that's a lot like a garage door opener that allows them to do exactly that.
I got to get one of them.
Me too.
All right, so tell us, we got to run, but tell us if they're interested, people in the community are interested in getting involved in EMS.
So I would say there's no better time to do so, because right now we are in shortage. It's a national shortage. It is a concerning shortage. We are retiring more people from the emergency medical services professions than we are seeing people enter the professions. You know, there's always the opportunity when it comes to crisis, and we are pretty close to crisis. I'm going to openly admit that. So there is plenty of opportunity out there. If it's something that you think is a lifestyle that is appealing to you, the idea of, you know, arriving on scene and in the worst of somebody's times, being able to lend a little stability and a little assistance at the same time, you know, maybe operating that ambulance or having it be that first step in a career in healthcare in general. Becoming an EMT is a relatively easy process. Most counties have an EMT training program. There are fewer paramedic training programs, and you do have to be an EMT before you become a paramedic. But ultimately, both of those things are relatively easy pathways for training. It is certainly a lot of information in a very short time, and you're then called upon to use that information during very high stress and very serious situations. But it takes a special kind of person. And if you think you might be that special kind of person, I would encourage you to contact your local police department, contact your local hospital. There are plenty of training programs out there, and all of them are accepting applicants at this point.
Awesome. Mark, thank you so much. Mark Bober, Director of Emergency Medical Services, Hackensack Meridian Health, JFK University Medical Center. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak.
Thanks for having me, Joel.
That was interesting, especially the part where the ambulances have a button they could change the light. I never thought that was true, and it is. Well, thank you for joining us on JFK Spotlight on Health. I'm Joel Katz. It's brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health, JFK University Medical Center. Keep getting better. You can check out a podcast at foxsportsradionewjersey.com of this or any of the previous broadcasts. You can check them out. And for more information or to find a doctor, anything, hackensackmeridianhealth.org. Have a great weekend.